So far, we've covered two methods for describing that an object has a shape, that a manifold has a shape. The first method was to introduce the metric. The metric can be used to determine the distance between neighboring points, and that contains all information about the shape. Consider, for example, let's say an object, the shape of the surface of a potato. If you sprinkle a lot of points on it, so that you have a fairly dense set of points sprinkled on that potato, and you record the distances between neighboring points, then from just that table of distances, you can reconstruct the shape of the potato up to the resolution that was given by the density of your sprinkling. That idea, by the way, I mentioned when I taught quantum field theory for cosmology, I think 3 years ago, and there were two students in class who picked up on that, and then we ended up writing a paper on it, and that paper has this HepDH number. It appeared in the meantime in FISREFD, and the message of that paper is quite nice, I think. The idea is that you can capture the distance between two points not only by taking a ruler and measuring how many centimeters it is, you can measure the distance between two points also by measuring how much the quantum fluctuations of a field here are correlated with the quantum fluctuations that it has over there. The closer the two points are, the more correlated are the quantum fluctuations. The further away they are, the less correlated they are. And in this paper, we show that if you only know the two-point functions of a quantum field, even a scalar field will do, then you can learn enough about the distances so that you can reconstruct the metric from that, and therefore all the curvature and so on. If you'd like to look into that, this is the number. Maybe you want to look into this for your essay, for example, if you're interested in that kind of thing. Right, so that was one method to capture the shape of a manifold, namely using the metric. And then we switched to another possibility, where we did not require a metric at all. Instead, we specified parallel transport, an affine connection, or covariant derivative, all the same. and we were based on the idea that you can determine whether or not a manifold is curved by parallel transporting a vector, such as the direction in which your arm is pointing, around a closed curve, and then checking whether your arm is still pointing in the same direction when you come back. We established that on the Earth that wouldn't be the case because the surface of the Earth is curved. Now, from that principle, we can derive key concepts, namely the curvature and the torsion of a manifold, to describe the very local properties. You see, taking a path is fine, like from the North Pole to the equator, but we really want to capture the shape of a manifold locally. And that is done by these two notions, torsion and curvature. So today we'll continue with the affine connection parallel transport approach to describing shape. And we will upgrade it by calculating torsion and curvature from the affine connection. So let's remember that we had the affine connection expressed in terms of the so-called Christoffel symbols. And those Christoffel symbols do not transform like a tensor does. Even though they have one upper and two lower indices, they only partially transform as if they were a one-fold contravariant and two-fold covariant tensor. That would be the appropriate transformation property if gamma was a tensor. So if that term was absent in the transformation law, then that would be a tensor. You see, the x tilde are the new coordinate system, the gamma tilde are the gammas in the new tilted coordinate system, and the untilded ones, the untilded x and the untilded gamma correspond to the old coordinate system. But there is this term, so the Christoffel symbols are not tensorial. The affine connection is not a tensor. However, if we look more closely, we see that a part of it, a part of the Christoffel symbol is a tensor, transforms like that. And to see this, let us decompose the Christoffel symbol into its symmetric and anti-symmetric parts. So the symmetric part of the Christoffel symbol is one half of the symmetric combination, where we, you know, interchange the position of the two lower indices. And the anti-symmetric part is by definition one half of the difference between gamma ij and gamma ji. The factor one half is put in there so that when you add the symmetric and the anti-symmetric parts, you just get back the original gamma. Well, and then what we find is that the anti-symmetric part of the Christoffel symbol, the anti-symmetric part of the affine connection, actually transforms tensorially. Only this is there, not that term. And the reason is that the anti-symmetric part, being anti-symmetric in A and P, kills that part, because a second derivative here with respect to xA and xB is naturally symmetric. And that, if you plug it in, means that it drops out. So this leads to the definition that the first definition, which is that the anti-symmetric part up to a factor of 2, the factor of 2 is undoing this one half here, the anti-symmetric part of the Christoffel symbol is called the torsion tensor. Since the torsion tensor is a tensor, since the anti-symmetric part is a tensor, we can conclude that the symmetric part cannot be, because the entire thing is not. In general relativity, we assume that there is no torsion. We assume that space-time doesn't have any torsion. We assume that the Christoffel symbols are always symmetric. And that's one way of expressing the equivalence principle. There are various versions of the equivalence principle, and this is sometimes also called the extended equivalence principle. So the idea here is that the Christoffel symbols gamma are expressing, after all, gravitational forces and tidal forces. Gravitational forces and pseudo forces. What does that mean? Well, pseudo forces are forces that you experience, for example, when you're on a carousel and it rotates very quickly, then you experience all kinds of forces. But that's because you are in an accelerated frame. It's not because suddenly there's a strong gravity that pulls you outwards. That is described by the Christoffel symbols. You can see that easily. Take, for example, Minkowski space and write down your equations of motion in funny coordinate systems, like in rotating ones. Then you get extra terms. And you don't get that the motion is a straight line anymore. And that would be attributed to pseudo forces. And mathematically, it is because the Christoffel symbols are non-zero. Remember that even when space is flat, the Christoffel symbols can be non-zero. They will be non-zero if you are in accelerated coordinate systems. They are accounting for the pseudo forces. But on top of that, the Christoffel symbols will also account for actual gravitational forces that are caused by the presence of masses. However, in any case, we want that locally, around any point in space-time, there should exist a coordinate system such that both the pseudo-forces and the gravitational forces vanish. So the demand of this equivalence principle is that it should always be possible to put yourself in a frame, and that would be the frame of free fall, to put yourself into a frame such that you do not experience any forces pulling you anywhere. There's sort of It's the idea that you're weightless when you are in free fall. It turns out that, strictly speaking, this rules out already the presence of torsion. It's a little subtle, though. Now, first of all, torsion is a tensor, as we said, and therefore it transforms in this way according to a change of coordinates. And in particular, if the torsion vanishes in one coordinate system, then it vanishes in all coordinate systems. And now the proposition that we will look at more closely is that vice versa also. If the torsion tensor vanishes at all points, then there is always a chart around every point such that locally the Christoffel symbols vanish. And if the torsion does not vanish, this cannot be guaranteed. If the torsion is finite, well, then there is generally no coordinate system in which the Christoffel symbols would vanish. Let us look at this a little bit more closely by constructing such special coordinate systems, free fall coordinate systems. They will be called Riemann normal coordinate systems or geodesic coordinates. For that, we will first have to define geodesics. Let's start by remembering that a vector field is called autoparallel to some path gamma. In other words, it consists of vectors that are parallel transported along a path gamma if the vector field doesn't change according to the covariant derivative when evaluated in the direction of the path. So explicitly, this means that if you look at the vector field along the path, then the derivative of the vector field along the path plus Christoffel symbol times this is equal to zero. We had this condition earlier on, and we said that from the theory of ordinary differential equations, we can guarantee that at least for a finite stretch, there is a unique solution to any initial condition that we may set here. So we can always parallel transport any vector we want, at least for a finite amount. Now, a geodesic is then defined as a curve into the manifold, parameterized by some t, which you can think of as the internal clock of somebody traveling along that geodesic, but you don't have to. And in fact, sometimes we cannot. For example, for a light ray, we cannot think of it having a clock because technically time stands still if you travel at the speed of light. And when you look at a geodesic that is space-like, well, then it's hopeless. Nobody can travel a space-like trajectory. So in general, t is just some parameter, but intuitively, you might think of t parameterizing the eigentime if it's a time-like curve. So a curve gamma parameterized by some parameter t into the manifold, so from t into the position in the manifold x of t, is called a geodesic if the tangent vector of that path is itself autoparallel. So if the tangent vector parallel transported in the direction of the tangent doesn't change, then that's what is a geodesic. So we can then quickly derive what the geodesic equation is by just using, instead of xi up here, we use the gamma dot in that equation. So in a chart, the geodesic equation is then this, which means in practice that if we are given the affine connection, if we're given the parallel transport on a manifold, then we can pick a point, we can pick an initial velocity, and so we have two initial conditions. Here we have a second order differential equation, and then we can go ahead and solve that and obtain a geodesic path. And again, the theory of ordinary differential equations tells us that given an initial condition, we always find a geodesic that will run for some non-zero length. Now, there's a simple technical observation that will be quite useful. Let's assume that we have a path which solves the geodesic equation. So let's say we have a path gamma of t, which has as its initial condition, as the initial velocity, the vector xi. So at the point P, we specify the initial velocity vector to be xi. Then the path, the value of gamma xi t is that point in the manifold where the geodesic arrives at time t. The geodesic, which started at time t equals zero with velocity xi, run until the time t is reached. This is the point in the manifold that we reach on that geodesic then. And from the geodesic equation, we have that if we take the geodesic described, or if we then take the path described by putting the value lambda, which lambda being some fixed number in here, then that will also solve the geodesic equation. In other words, if we rescale, if we reparameterize the time variable by multiplying it with a number lambda, then that will also obey the geodesic equation. You see, you get then a factor of lambda here, a factor of lambda there, two factors of lambda over there. And in particular, we have that if we take the path, the geodesic, which starts with lambda times the initial velocity and run it for the time t, then we arrive at the same point, this one, as if we started with the initial velocity xi, but run for time lambda t. That doesn't matter because it just pulls through the differential equation. I'll leave it to you as a little exercise to show that. Okay, so keep that in mind. Whether we run with a higher initial velocity for the time t, or the original initial velocity, but for a longer time, we arrive at the same point. This we can now use to define the so-called exponential map. Let's consider a fixed point in the manifold. We want to construct basically a falling elevator around that fixed point. One of those coordinate systems in which you don't feel any pseudo or gravitational forces. So we choose a fixed point P in the manifold. Then we define the exponential map in the following way. The exponential map will be a map which maps from the tangent space at the point P into the manifold. So you pick a tangent vector and you get a point in the manifold. Simply by choosing a tangent vector as the initial velocity, and then you run your geodesic until time t equal to 1, just arbitrarily set t equal to 1. So you see, in this way, for whatever tangent vector you choose, for whatever initial velocity you choose, after 1 second, if that's the unit you want, after 1 second of running the geodesic equation, you arrive at some point of the manifold. And that point of the manifold will be called xp of xi. So it's the exponential map applied at the point p with initial velocity xi. So gamma is the geodesic with initial location p and initial velocity xi. See, this gives us a coordinate system. Because choosing a tangent vector is choosing a bunch of points. It's choosing a bunch of coefficients. And you choose your tangent vector and you get a point of a manifold. For every point of the manifold, as far as geodesics are unique, you get uniquely a tangent vector that gets you there. an initial velocity vector that gets you there. From G, let's see, G was this property here, namely that it doesn't matter whether you rescale the initial velocity or the time variable, you arrive at the same point. We have that if you run the geodesic with initial velocity xi for an amount of time lambda, it's the same as if you run the geodesic with lambda times the initial velocity for one unit of time, and running the geodesic equation for one unit of time with initial velocity lambda xi is the exponential map. So the exponential map for the initial velocity vector lambda xi is the same as gamma of xi at time lambda. This gives us geodesic or Riemann normal coordinates. Geodesic coordinates or Riemann normal coordinates. Those, I'll explain in a moment some more about it, but let me just anticipate that this is not going to be a coordinate system for the entire manifold. In general, it's not going to be. And that's because when you start with a point P and then specify an initial velocity and run the geodesic until one unit of time is up, then you get to some point of the manifold. If you choose another initial velocity vector, xi prime, and you run the geodesic equation for one unit of time, you arrive generally at another point of the manifold. Or you might arrive at the same point of the manifold that you did before. And that's because the whole thing is curved, and it could be the two geodesics eventually, and they might diverge initially, but maybe they come back together and cross. And when they intersect, then you have that you could have started with this initial velocity vector and arrive after one unit of time over there, or with that initial velocity vector and arrive at the same point. This is the boundary of how far you can go with your Riemann normal coordinate system. It's only a good coordinate system in what is called a geodesically convex region, as far as you can go before geodesics start intersecting themselves again. So the exponential map around a point P is a diffeomorphism from a neighborhood of the origin in the tangent vector space to P, because that's where we draw our initial velocities from. And of course, when the initial velocities are very low, then after one unit of time, we're not going to go very far on the manifold. If the initial velocity is zero, then we're just sticking at the point P. So the exponential map is a diffeomorphism whose domain is a neighborhood around the origin in the tangent space. And the tangent space is isomorphic to Rn into a neighborhood of the point P of the manifold. So we have a diffeomorphism from a subset of Rn, a region of Rn around the origin in Rn into the manifold. So it provides a chart around the point P. If we choose a basis in the tangent space of about the point P, let's say a basis named E1 to En, then every initial velocity vector has coefficients xi I with respect to this basis. And therefore, every point in the manifold that can be reached from this geodesics within the domain of the validity of the exponential map, that is before geodesics cross, has a unique set of coordinates xi I. So the xi I become the coordinates of points in the neighborhood of our point P in the manifold. So these n tuples of numbers get mapped into the output of the exponential map, which is points of the manifold. And this kind of coordinate system is called normal coordinate systems, Riemann normal coordinate systems, or geodesic coordinate systems. In these geodesic coordinate systems, geodesics are special, obviously, and in particular, Think about it this way. If this is the manifold, let's look at the point P and geodesics that run through the point P. Well, here's a geodesic that doesn't run through the point P. It's just some curve. And the geodesics that do run through the point P in general may look like this. This is in a generic coordinate system. If we use a Riemann normal coordinate system, however, then that same situation looks different. In the Riemann normal coordinate system, all of this plays out in the tangent space about the point of the point P in a small region around the origin. And here's the origin of the tangent space. So this point is zero velocity. And then how do geodesics look like? Well, in a Riemann normal coordinate system, generic geodesics like this one will still look generic. They don't have to be straight lines in this coordinate system. But not so with geodesics that run through the origin. Geodesics that run through the origin in a Riemann normal coordinate system are always straight lines. And that's simply the way that the Riemann normal coordinate system is defined by construction. Right? So as you increase the velocity, you just run proportionally along the coordinate system, along the coordinates. So what we have is that at the origin of a Riemann normal coordinate system, geodesics are straight lines. You're just traveling at constant velocity along. This is how geodesics look like in a Riemann normal coordinate system. But only the geodesics that run through the origin, and just because we constructed the coordinate system in the exact way such that this is the case. Now, does that mean that the Christoffel symbols have to vanish at the origin? Given that we don't see any curvature of the geodesics here or anything else that would indicate that there are tidal forces or gravitational forces or pseudo forces. Now, technically, maybe surprisingly, it doesn't mean that. See, one could imagine an equivalence principle that says, well, because of this, we want the, you could imagine an equivalence principle that says we want general relativity to be such that there is always a coordinate system in which the geodesics through the origin are straight lines and then be done with it. That would be an equivalence principle. But then you can extend it and say, no, we want more than that. We want not only that the geodesics through the origin become straight lines for a suitable coordinate system. No, we also want that the Christoffel symbols actually vanish. And that's an extra condition, and that's a condition that rules out torsion. Let's see how that works out. So the geodesic equation at the point P is this equation, but by the way that we constructed the Riemann normal coordinate system, geodesics through the origin are just motions of just constant speed motion. Straight line, no acceleration. So at the origin of a Riemann normal coordinate system, we have in particular that this second derivative vanishes. And that means that this expression has to vanish. And if we decompose the Christoffel symbol now into its symmetric and anti-symmetric part, we see what this condition, the equivalence principle, implies. Well, it implies that the symmetric part plus the anti-symmetric part times these two factors is equal to zero. I'm just writing this expression equal to zero and spelling out what the Christoffel symbol is when we decompose it. But you see, the anti-symmetric part drops out of this equation because, well, it's anti-symmetric here, and these two guys are symmetric, these two indices I and j. Therefore, that term drops out no matter what. Even if gamma anti-symmetric is huge, It doesn't matter. The only condition that we obtain from this, the only condition that we obtain from requiring that the geodesics to the origin are straight lines, is that the symmetric part of the Christoffel symbol vanishes. The antisymmetric part may still be large. So it requires an extra condition, the extended equivalence principle, to say, no, we want more than that. We want that the antisymmetric part, even though it's not required from that consideration, we want that the antisymmetric part of the Christoffel symbols vanishes as well. So that's a condition that you cannot see in the motion of geodesics. You can see it when you use the Christoffel symbol for other purposes. For example, you have covariant derivatives in non-abelian gauge theories or something like that, where you have complicated expressions where you can have that the index I couples differently than the index j to various tensors whose dynamics we are describing. So those things would be affected. So general force fields would be affected by the presence of torsion, but you don't see torsion affecting the shape of the geodesics there. That's why it's an extended principle. So what we see is that, as we said before, if the torsion vanishes, so if this is not a concern, if the torsion vanishes, then for each point in the manifold, there exists a chart in which the entire gravity and pseudo force field vanishes at P, so the Christoffel symbols vanish. So the equivalence principle is equivalent to requiring that there is a coordinate system in which the Christoffel symbols vanish, only if the torsion vanishes. So what is it about torsion? What is this mysterious thing? What does it mean geometrically?
Sorry, can I have just one question about this statement? The Christoffel zero at point P, right? Can you make it vanish for the entire geodesics?
No.
Like, is there no coordinates where?
In general, not. No. You can make it vanish at the origin, but not in general. Not in finite regions. So what does torsion mean geometrically? Let's assume that Xi1 and Xi2 are tangent vectors at the point P of the manifold. Then we define what is called a torsion map. The torsion map takes in two tangent vectors and maps them into a tangent vector. So it maps from the Cartesian product of the tangent vector space with itself. So it maps from the set of pairs. This is what the cross means. Remember, it's a set of pairs, one element from here, one element from there. So tau maps two tangent vectors into one tangent vector. And in particular, it does it in such a way that the torsion map's output is the covariant derivative of Xi2 in the direction of Xi1 minus the opposite minus the commutator of Xi1 and Xi2. And by the way, this is also the Lie derivative of Xi2 in the direction of Xi1. Just to remind you of that. So why is that a good definition? Where does all of this lead? We will get to the geometric meaning in a minute. But before that, we will do an exercise that will come up quite a bit in this course. We will quite freely transform maps into tensors and tensors into maps. In particular, here we have a map that takes two tangent vectors in and outputs a tangent vector. From that map, tau, the torsion map, we can define the torsion tensor, capital tau. And the torsion tensor is a tensor which is one-fold contravariant and two-fold covariant. And that tensor will be equivalent to the torsion map. How is that? Well, let's see what such a tensor can do. Such a tensor, because it's twofold covariant, if you plug two tangent vectors into it, then you satisfy those 2 degrees of freedom here, and you're left with a tangent vector. So if you take that tensor, you plug 2 tangent vectors in there, you get a tangent vector, so you can view such a tensor as a map. And so we define for this, we want this map that comes out of that to be this one. So generally, you can turn tensors into maps, and maps into tensors by this trick. So we define the tangent map, the torsion tensor from the torsion map, in such a way that the torsion tensor, when fed 2 tangent vectors here to satisfy those 2 slots, and 1 cotangent vector to be fed into that contravariant slot, then you get a number out of this, right? So you take the tangent, you take the torsion tensor, and you feed it 1 cotangent vector for this factor and 2 tangent vectors for those 2 covariant entries, then you get a number, and that number is supposed to be the same number as what you get when you take the torsion map up here, which takes 2 tangent vectors as input, give you 1 tangent vector as output, and then you take the evaluation of that tangent vector against that cotangent vector. Remember, this Bragg-Ketz notation is sometimes used to describe the evaluation of a cotangent vector against a tangent vector. In principle, we could also have written simply omega of that, right? It's simply a cotangent vector applied to a tangent vector. But when the argument becomes more extensive, like tau of psi 1, comma psi 2, and so on, then in order to keep the notation less cluttered, not so many brackets of brackets, we use a bracket notation like this. Okay, so the torsion tensor is defined to be that tensor which, when interpreted as a map in the way that I just explained, is the torsion map. All of these things work out nicely because it's linear. For nonlinear maps, you couldn't do it this way.
Is this bracket notation anything to do with in the product?
Very good question. And the answer is no. No, you have to be careful there. It could easily be mixed up with it. But this is the evaluation of a cotangent vector against a vector. That is something that you can do even before a metric is defined. Because cotangent vectors act as linear maps from the tangent vectors into the real numbers. You don't need a metric for that. You would need a metric, an inner product, if you wanted to evaluate 2 tangent vectors into a number, or 2 cotangent vectors into a number. But here we have a tangent vector and a cotangent vector. And all of these studies of the previous lecture and this one are without a metric. So far we've not used any metric here. Okay, so now we had defined the torsion already. We said the torsion tensor is simply the anti-symmetric part of the Christoffel symbol. Now we define the torsion tensor again, but we defined it very differently. Instead of saying it's the anti-symmetric part of the Christoffel symbol, we said it's this complicated thing. We said it is this tensor here, this tensor here, which is the tensor version of that map. And that map has this complicated form, covariant derivative of 2 vector fields in 2 different ways, minus a commutator between the 2 vector fields. How can that be the same as the anti-symmetric part of the Christoffel symbols? Well, let's see. Let us choose the bases that come with a choice of coordinate system, as dxk and d by dxi. Then, by definition, as we defined it just now, the torsion tensor has components, the coefficients of the torsion tensor are what you get when you take this basis vector, the omega in this case, and evaluate it against that. You see, this is a cotangent vector acting on a tangent vector. I'm sorry for having switched the notation so quickly, but in the previous slide, this was a bra, this, comma, and then a ket. Okay? It's the same thing. So I could also write this as the bra bracket here, dxk, comma, and then this stuff, and then again this angular bracket on the right. In fact, that's the next line. Okay, and now we have to evaluate that. So let's evaluate this thing here. Remember, that's the torsion map. And the torsion map was covariant derivative of one vector field with respect to the direction of the other, minus the other way around, minus the commutator of the two. Now the commutator between those two partial derivatives is of course zero, so that thing goes away. And these are just Christoffel symbols. These are Christoffel symbols times the basis vectors. So we get Christoffel symbol times basis vector, Christoffel symbol times basis vector. This is how we defined the affine connection in the first place. So now we have to evaluate these cotangent vectors against these tangent vectors. The gammas are just coming along for the ride. They are just scalar prefactor functions. Of course, the dxk evaluate against the d by dx mu as Kronecker deltas. So we obtain that this is gamma matrix times Kronecker delta minus gamma matrix times Kronecker delta. We contract the Kronecker deltas and we obtain what we had before. We find that the torsion tensor is the antisymmetric part of the Christoffel symbol. Now let's see what the geometric meaning is of torsion after all this preparation here. So in brief, torsion, if there is torsion in a manifold, it means that infinitesimal parallelograms don't close. If, for example, you start at a point P, then you travel in the direction of xi, and then you travel in the direction of eta, you arrive at a point. If you instead travel infinitesimally first in the eta direction and then in the xi direction, you arrive at, in principle, another point. And when there is torsion, these two points are not the same. Without torsion, you're guaranteed to arrive at the same point. The non-trivial piece of this is that after you've traveled infinitesimally in the direction of xi, and then you want to travel in the direction of eta, well, you first have to parallel transport your eta vector over here. You see, when you start your travels, either this way around or that way around, initially you make up your mind what the two vectors are that you want to use to build your parallelogram. So while you're here, you make up your mind what should be my xi, what should be my eta vector. And once you've done that, you travel in the direction of the xi vector while parallel transporting your eta vector along. It then becomes the eta tilde vector. And then you travel infinitesimally in the eta tilde direction. Or, and that's the alternative trip, you start walking in the eta direction while parallel transporting your xi vector along, and then you walk infinitesimally in the xi direction. Now, let's remember how parallel transport works. The parallel transport equation, not the geodesic equation, the parallel transport equation, is this one. So let's see. Let's say we want to walk here from P to Q to U. Or we want to walk eta and then from with eta to r and then onwards to u bar. Yeah, in the second case, we travel eta and we drag along, we parallel transport along the vector xi so that we then have it over here. We call it xi tilde when it arrives there. And then we walk the xi tilde path. So the xi tilde vector is going to be at the location x plus eta, so we want to know what is xi tilde at the location x. The point x is the coordinates of the point p. the coordinates, x are the coordinates of the point P. X tilde at x plus eta I is what we need to know. We need to know what is the vector psi once it's parallel transported over here. And it is the original vector plus the change that, that you incur when you travel in that direction along the path set by eta. Now, we use that the V here is the direction xi, that's the vector that we want to parallel transport, and the direction in which we want to parallel transport, that's the dxi by dt. Right? So the dx by dt is the velocity in which we want to travel, and that's the velocity vector eta. So we plug that into this equation. Dx by dt is the direction vector in that is this one. And the vector that we want to parallel transport is the v. It's the xi, and so we obtain the d xi by dt in this way from that. So d xi by dt is dv by dt, and here we have the eta, and here we have the xi. So the parallel transport of our xi vector to the new point r over there is the original vector minus Christoffel symbol times eta xi. Now, this means that the coordinates of this point over here are the original coordinates of the point P, which is x, plus we traveled by the vector eta, and then we traveled by the vector xi tilde. But the xi tilde vector is the xi vector with this modification because of the parallel transport. So it's x plus eta plus xi minus this. If all of that happened on flat space, then all we would have is this. And clearly, if we had instead traveled that way and that way, it would still be just this, and we arrive at the same point u all the time, it would always be the point with these coordinates. But not so, we traveled this way and then that way on a curved manifold, and that means that the point that we arrive at is this one with this slight modification. If we now travel that way and then that way, then we have to redo the same calculation with the role of the eta and the xi interchanged. Everything else the same. But wherever there was an eta, there's a xi now, and vice versa. So we get the same formula as this one, except that the eta and the xi will have their roles interchanged. And you see how that exactly picks up on antisymmetry in here. So analogously, we obtain same equation here, but with these two variables switched, which means that this point here that we arrive there, the point u, is the point where these two are switched. So the coordinate distance then from the point u to the point u bar, the point that we arrive at this way, and the point that we arrive at by going that way, the coordinate distance is given by the difference between these two perturbations there, and that's the difference between the Christoffel symbols times these etas and xi. In principle, I should write down the same Christoffel symbol with the same index structure, but with the etas and the xi interchange, but that's the same thing, of course, if I change the sequence of the indices or the sequence of the two vectors there. So what we see that is that the distance between the coordinate distance between those two points is that. Where of course implicitly we assumed that the values of xi and eta are infinitesimal. What we calculated here, all right. What we calculated here was the parallel transport of the vector xi along the first leg, the direction of eta. And we found that it is xi plus d xi by dt, that's just first order Taylor expansion. And then that coefficient we got from the orthoparallel equation, it was just that. We can write this also as that this is xi, and then we have that term just carrying forward. So I'm carrying forward this term here, I'm carrying forward that term to over there. And then let's add this term and subtract it again. Or actually here we added it and there we subtracted it. These two terms are the same and they just cancel each other, one with the plus, one with the minus, and they are not up there. The reason why I'm putting them there is that this term combines with that term to become a covariant derivative. See, this is just the ordinary derivative. This is the Christoffel symbol. And so the advantage is that we can see this expansion, this parallel transport of the xi tilde, to be the original coordinates of that tangent vector, minus, and now this entire bracket here is just a covariant derivative. This comma becomes a semicolon because of these Christoffel symbols here, plus that extra term over here. And so what we can do is we can write the coordinate distance from u to u bar, because we can do the same thing for the parallel transport of the eta tilde, in this way. Namely that the new coordinates are x plus eta plus xi, plus this extra coefficient, this one, but this coefficient we can write in that way, which is that over here. This would be the point u bar, the coordinates of the point u bar, and these are the coordinates of the point u. And the difference between those two is, of course, that, I mean, these terms, of course, go away. And these terms have the opposite index structure to those. And that's going to be our torsion tensor as we had before. The point I want to make is that when we earlier defined the torsion tensor as this, as arising from the torsion map, and the torsion map had all those complicated terms in there, we recover these terms now. You see, the torsion tensor, the torsion map, we defined to be the covariant derivative of xi in the direction of eta minus the other way around, minus that commutator. And when we first reduced that formula to the simple case, that the simple way that we had defined the torsion tensor earlier, namely just as the antisymmetric part of the Christoffel symbol, we simply did that by saying we choose the canonical basis, the dxi and the d by dxj. As we did so, several terms went away, like this term went away, because we had d by dxi, d by dxj, that commutator went away. And so you might think, well, why did we have that term anyway? Wouldn't it suffice to just drop that term? But if we write it in this way, then you see that all those terms arise. We get the covariant derivatives, this term and that term, they are responsible for these two. And this term and that term are producing that commutator here. So there is a way to see directly that we just get the antisymmetric part of the Christoffel symbol. But if we want to know why in the abstract formulation we really need all of those terms, then it's useful to write it in this covariantized fashion. And then we see the origin of all those terms. It's just a matter of some terms being absent when you make a particular choice of basis. But we want to know things basis independently.
So regarding your torsion map, right? So mm-hmm. the commutator part.
Yes.
That means if I choose a bad non-coordinate basis, then will torsion just appear out of nowhere?
No, actually. Okay, so you're referring to the fact that we have a freedom to choose any choice, you can make any choice of basis in the tangent and cotangent spaces, that's right. And when we derive now the formulas for the torsion and the Riemann curvature tensor, then we will not make use of that freedom just yet. Later in the course, we will make use of that freedom, and we will see that there will be extra terms in the formulas, which we can use, which we can choose to be of a suitable form so that they annihilate other terms and our expressions become simpler. So initially, we will not use it yet, but we will use that.
But is that correct to say that if I choose certain coordinates, I can keep that commutator non-zero?
Well, that commutator, of course, is always coordinate system dependent, right? So what I mean is that, the commutator itself is not coordinate system dependent, but what I mean is you can use your vector fields, for example, and if you choose coordinates such that the such that your directional derivatives that you get from the vector fields are in the direction of your coordinates locally at a point, then they would be commuting. Yes. But in general, of course, torsion is a tensor, so you can't do anything about, you can't make it vanish by choosing a third coordinate system. If it is zero, you can't make it non-zero. You can change its coefficients, but you can't change it from zero to non-zero. Now that we've done torsion, where are we? Curvature. Assume that, so we will do a very similar analysis here, but skipping a few of the details because it's similar to the torsion case. Assume that we have three tangent vectors at the point P of the manifold, then we define a curvature map, similar to how we define the torsion map. The curvature map will be called R, and the curvature tensor will also be called R, but they're in principle two different things. The curvature map is defined to be the map that takes three tangent vectors and maps them into this expression. So, three tangent vectors are mapped into a tangent vector by taking the second covariant derivatives. So, you covariantly differentiate in the direction of psi 2, afterwards in the direction of psi 1, minus the other way around, minus the covariant derivative in the direction of the commutator of psi 3. So, you apply all of this stuff, you apply that tangent vector here, you apply this action here on the tangent vector psi 3. And we say that this operator, and this bracket here, is an operator that we also call the curvature map. So it's a little bit confusing, but both carry that name curvature map. This operator that maps as a second covariant derivative operator on psi 3, but also this entire thing here, which maps three tangent vectors into a tangent vector, is also called the curvature map. So maybe this should be the curvature operator, and it would be the curvature map. The same way that we turned the torsion map into a torsion tensor, and vice versa, we can also take this curvature map and turn it into a curvature tensor. You see, this map takes three tangent vectors as input and will give you one tangent vector as output. This is what a 1-3 tensor does. You see, a 1-3 tensor has three openings to be filled by tangent vectors. And once you've done that, you're left with a tangent vector. So a 1-3 tensor can be thought of as a map that takes three tangent vectors as input and gives you one tangent vector as output. And concretely, the association between the two, map between the two, is given by requiring that you get the same result whether you take your 1-3 tensor and feed it with three tangent vectors and a cotangent vector, three tangent vectors, psi 1, psi 2, psi 3, and then a cotangent vector to feed into that contravariant slot, that should give you always the same number as if you took the curvature map, then feed the two first tangent vectors into the curvature operator, apply to psi 3. This is the action of the curvature map. It gives you as output a tangent vector, which you can evaluate against that cotangent vector. So all of this is just to say that a 1-3 tensor can be viewed as a map from three tangent vectors into a tangent vector. How does that look like in a chart now? And again, we choose as our chart, whatever chart we choose, we go along with the coordinates, with the basis vectors that come suggested with that chart. So we will be putting in here the dxi and the d by dx mu. Again, following up on your question from earlier, we don't have to do that. We could put other basis vectors here, and we would get other formulas. And we can use that freedom to massage these expressions, and in particular, if we choose arbitrary bases, then we get extra terms here, and we can then require that some of these terms, for example, cancel each other out, and that will give us conditions on how to conveniently choose those bases. But for now, let us just choose the bases that come along with the coordinate system and see what we get. So if we choose these coordinate system suggested bases, then the components of the Riemann curvature tensor, so in other words, the actual numbers that we get out of this, oh, where are we now? Right. Right, so we said that this map is equivalent to that tensor by requiring that the numbers that you get by filling all the openings with vectors and covectors are the same as when you do it over here. And what are these numbers? These numbers are the coefficients of the Riemann curvature tensor if you put here basis vectors in there. So we plug the d by dxi, d by dxj, d by dxk, dxi basis vectors in there, and then we evaluate all of this into numbers, and these are the numbers that are called the coefficients or the matrix elements of the Riemann curvature tensor. So here they are. We plug in these values, these basis vectors, dxi just carried forward, and the Riemann curvature map is doing this. Remember, it's the commutator of the covariant derivatives and the covariant derivative of the commutator, but the commutator of just these basis vectors is zero, so conveniently that term goes away. It wouldn't go away if it chose an arbitrary basis in the space of tangent vectors. What we have is covariant derivative acting on these basis vectors, but covariant derivative acting on a basis vector, well, that's just the definition of the affine connection. We get Christoffel symbol times basis vector. Same here. This one acting on these basis vectors gives us Christoffel symbol times basis vector. And these two derivatives are just carried forward. Now, these are just coefficient functions here. And these are basis vectors. And we have to covariant differentiate these things. At this point, you should think Leibniz rule. Covariant derivative of a scalar function times a vector. So this is the covariant derivative of that, leaving this the same, plus leaving that the same, and the covariant derivative of this. So what is the covariant derivative then of a coefficient function, a scalar full coefficient function? Well, that's just the ordinary derivative, right? The covariant derivative of an ordinary scalar function is the ordinary derivative. So that's this first term here. It's Christoffel symbol differentiated ordinarily in the direction of d by dxk. So it's a comma k. And then multiplied with this basis vector that's over here on the right. And then we get another term by the product rule where we leave this the same, and then we have the covariant differentiate this basis vector in that direction, but that just gives us Christoffel symbol times basis vector. So that's the origin of having two types of terms in this expression for the Riemann curvature tensor. We get terms that are derivatives of Christoffel symbols and squares of Christoffel symbols. We get here a derivative term and a square, and here a derivative term and a square. We can evaluate this basis vector against that basis vector. All the rest is just coefficient functions. And so overall, we just get this. These numbers, these matrix elements, are given by those coefficients. So the expression of the Riemann curvature tensor in terms of the Christoffel symbols, if we choose the basis that comes along with the coordinate system, is this. If we chose another basis, it would be another expression. Now, how does this square with our observation earlier on that there is always a coordinate system in which the Christoffel symbol vanishes at the origin? Doesn't that mean because the Riemann curvature tensor is expressed entirely in Christoffel symbols? That would seem to indicate that there's always a coordinate system at whose origin the Christoffel symbols vanish, and therefore the curvature tensor vanishes. But if the curvature tensor vanishes in one coordinate system, it vanishes in all coordinate systems. It's a tensor after all. What's wrong with that logic?
Derivatives.
Exactly. Derivatives. Right? And it also is important regarding your question, can we have that the Christoffel symbols are vanishing in an extended patch? Right? That would mean that, you know, there would be a coordinate system in which those also vanished. And then we could conclude that curvature would have to vanish. So yes, there are curvature terms, there are derivatives, and at the origin of a Riemann normal coordinate system, these are the only terms that survive. At the origin of a Riemann normal coordinate system, the Riemann curvature tensor is given by just this expression here. So what then is the curvature tensor's meaning? Well, it contains derivatives of gamma. And the gammas themselves enter into the geodesic equation. But here we have derivatives of gamma. So the gammas enter in the geodesic equation, which means that the gammas directly affect the paths of geodesics with pseudo forces and gravitational forces. But here we have derivatives of gamma. And what that means is that the curvature expresses variation in the gravitational forces. The Riemann curvature tensor expresses tidal forces. It expresses changes in the gravity. I mean, for example, if the moon was much closer to the Earth, it would be ripped apart. And that's because the tidal forces would rip it apart. You can think of it this way. The further away the moon is from the Earth, the longer is its orbit. So if the moon was very far away from the Earth, it would perhaps take 2 months to go once around Earth rather than 1 month. If the moon was much closer to the Earth, it might make that tour in 10 days. Now, if the moon is very close to the Earth, then the part of the moon that is closest to the Earth may want to orbit in like 10 days. The part of the moon that is further away from the Earth, just the other side of the moon, might want to go around the Earth in 11 days, you see? So they want to go around the Earth in different speeds because they feel gravity at different strengths. And that is the origin of the tidal forces. It's in fact the reason why the moon is always showing the same side to us. If the moon was rotating, it would permanently, while it is rotating, it would always be deformed as it rotates, and that costs its energy. And initially, the moon surely rotated relative to us, but that was like a permanent kneading of it, it's just like on the Earth. We have tidal forces, we have tides on the Earth, and that is slowing down the Earth. the energy that tidal power stations withdraw, they really withdraw from the rotation of the Earth. And so similar, the Moon would have had a bulge pointing towards the Earth and a bulge pointing away from the Earth, and the Moon rotates underneath it, and that would create tremendous stresses in the rock. It did so for many millions of years until it slowed down so much, the friction overcame that rotational energy. It was all used up and turned into heat. And ever since, the Moon has always shown us the same side. Anyway, the curvature tensor measures tidal forces. It measures the variation of the strength of the gravitational force. Now, geometrically, curvature expresses the non-commutativity of parallel transport. Let's see how that comes about. Now, we won't do that in all as much detail as we did for the torsion tensor because it's very similar. But here's the gist of it. There's a proposition called the Ricci identity. Let's assume that the torsion vanishes, which is to say, let's assume that parallelograms close. So if you go in the direction of eta, and then in the direction of nu being the parallel transported version of the vector nu here, then you arrive at the same point as if you were first going in the direction of nu and then in the direction of the parallel transported eta. So you can go this parallelogram and you will return back to where you started. Imagine you want to parallel transport now some vector, let's say xi, arbitrary vector. It's not a direction in which you want to walk. It's just some arbitrary vector, maybe the direction in which your arm is pointing. And let's say you parallel transport that vector this way, that way, or you can also transport it that way or that way, or you just transport it all the way around. And then, very similar to what we discussed at the very beginning of this topic, namely starting at the North Pole, walking to the equator, and then walking along the equator, then walking back up to the North Pole and checking whether your arm is still pointing in the same direction. Here we have an infinitesimal version of that in a parallelogram. Now, what the Ricci identity is saying is that when you take the second covariant derivative and you either do it this way or you do it that way, so you take a vector xi and you parallel transport it either first in the direction of eta and then in the direction of nu, or you do it the other way around, then, or you take the minus of it, which effectively means you parallel transport it this way, that way, and then that way, and then that way, and back, then you will find that the vector generally will have rotated a little bit because of your parallel transport around a parallelogram. And the amount that it has rotated is given by the Riemann curvature tensor. And technically, it means that the difference between the two covariant derivatives carried out in first the eta, then the new direction, or vice versa, is given by the Riemann curvature tensor times xi b. So the geometry of it, if you just do it the same way as we did for the torsion tensor, I'll leave it to you as an exercise to plug in the numbers there. What you obtain is that the change in the vector xi, as you run around the parallelogram, the change in the vector xi is given by the Riemann curvature tensor, contracted with the vectors eta and nu, and also contracted with the vector of xi. This has a simple interpretation. Imagine you start out at this point and you choose three vectors. Two vectors to span the parallelogram, eta and nu. So you pick the coefficients eta I, you pick the coefficients nu, and you pick a vector xi that is supposed to be taken on that right. Then, overall, this vector is going to be rotated, so that the original vector and the parallel transported vector around the parallelogram are not pointing in the same direction. There's a difference vector. That difference vector is given by take the eta and the nu coefficients contract them with the Riemann curvature tensor, and then you're left with an object that has two indices left, namely A and D. Okay, after you contract the first two lower indices with the vectors eta and nu that span the parallelogram, you're left with an object with two indices, and that's a rotation matrix. It's a rotation matrix, or if it's the Lorentzian signature, then it's a Lorentz transformation. And it will rotate your vector xi so that it goes from here to there. So the Riemann curvature tensor is really a rotation matrix or a Lorentz transformation for each choice of eta and nu that you may contract it with here. So the upper and lower index, the upper index and the last lower index are the rotation that is being done by this parallel transport. Let me see how we are doing with the time. Not so great. Let me skip the proof of the Ricci identity. It's a straightforward calculation, really. Instead, let us look at the so-called Bianchi identities. So the Bianchi identities are identities that are true no matter what. By that I mean these are equations that look like equations of motion in general relativity, but they are not, because there was no choice of action, no choice of Hamiltonian or Lagrangian involved. It's similar to electromagnetism's equation that dF equal to zero. If F, the field strength tensor, is an exact form as electromagnetism requires, then the fact that dF is equal to zero follows just because d squared is equal to zero. So that wasn't a choice. It's just in the structure of the mathematics that the dF is equal to zero. So the homogeneous Maxwell equations are not dependent on any choice of action, Lagrangian or Hamiltonian. Similarly, in general relativity, there are equations that hold true, that can be useful, and yet they are not equations of motion of the usual kind. They come about automatically. And these are so-called Bianchi identities. They hold just by construction. So to get to those Bianchi identities, we need a little preparation. Let us look at, remember we saw that maps, linear maps of tensors into tensors can themselves be viewed as tensors. For example, the torsion map can be viewed as a torsion tensor, the curvature map can be viewed as a curvature tensor, and vice versa. Now, tensors we can covariantly differentiate. But how about maps? We can also covariantly differentiate maps simply by covariantly differentiating the tensors that they correspond to. So, consider an arbitrary linear map on our manifold. So K takes N or R tangent vectors into K of the xi 1 to the xi R, and this, let's say, shall be a tangent vector again. This definition applies, for example, to the torsion map, also to the curvature map. You take some tangent vectors in, you get a tangent vector out. In the case of the torsion map, you take two tangent vectors in, you get a tangent vector out. In the case of the curvature map, you take three tangent vectors in, get a tangent vector out. And what that meant was that K can also be viewed as a map. I mean, it is a map from the R-fold contravariant tensor space into the tangent vector space. And as we discussed earlier, it also means that we can view K as a tensor, if you may want to give a different name, K tilde, which is a tensor in the tensor space 1R. Because if it is R-fold covariant, it means you can plug R tangent vectors in it. And when you've done that, you're left with a tangent vector. And remember, just like we did before for the torsion and for the curvature, we define the tensor corresponding to the map by saying that if I take the tensor and I feed it our tangent vectors to fulfill these indices, and one cotangent vector to contract with that index, it should give me always the same number as if I took the original map, which maps our tangent vectors into one tangent vector and then contracted with the omega. Now, with this little map, we can define the covariant derivative also to act on maps. Namely, we say that the covariant derivative in the direction of xi of our map k, acting on all those tangent vectors evaluated against the cotangent vector, should always be, I mean, it is supposed to be that, it's by definition, that tensor over here, which has the property that when filled with all those entries and then contracted against the omega, always gives you the same number as if you took the tensor k tilde that we just defined and covariantly differentiated it as usual. So this is a known concept, and this is what we define through it. Then, using this definition, we can express the, we can write down the first and second Bianchi identities for the torsion map and for the curvature map. All of these things could also be written down directly for the curvature tensor and for the torsion tensor, but it would be a little bit more tedious. So the first Bianchi identity says that if you take the Riemann curvature map with three tangent vectors psi, eta, and nu, and you sum over cyclic permutations, which is to say you really have three terms here. The sum runs over three terms. The first term has a xi, eta, nu here. The second term has a nu, xi, eta. And the third term has an eta, nu, xi. Just cyclically rotate the three. And this is equal to the cyclic sum. Again, it's three terms in this sum. Of all those terms with a torsion map here. But you have the covariant derivative of the torsion map acting on this. That gives you, again, a tangent vector. Here you have a tangent vector come out, and then that tangent vector gets along with this tangent vector into that torsion map, gives you a tangent vector again, etc. So the right-hand side is a tangent vector, the left-hand side is a tangent vector. This Bianchi identity looks super complicated, and when you all spell it out, it's a non-trivial looking equation, but it's just simply always true. And the second Bianchi identity also involves both the Riemann curvature tensor and the torsion. Now, luckily in GR, torsion doesn't seem to play a role, and therefore these two equations dramatically simplify, and all of this right-hand side goes away, and this equation simply becomes a statement about the symmetry structure of the indices of the Riemann curvature tensor. And down here, similarly, this term goes away because the torsion goes away, and that becomes an equation about the symmetry structure of the covariant derivative, the first covariant derivative of the Riemann curvature tensor. Now, these equations are automatically obeyed, just like the homogeneous Maxwell equations are automatically obeyed. And let me give you an example of why this is so by proving the first Bianchi identity. We won't prove the second, but let's prove the first one. So let's prove the first Bianchi identity, and let's prove it under the assumption, to keep things relatively simple, that the right-hand side vanishes because there's no torsion. If we do that, and that's the last slide, then we have to prove this equation here. So what is this? Let us write out what the Riemann, what the curvature map is. Remember, it was covariant derivative, minus the other way around, acting on u, minus the covariant derivative of the commutator, plus cyclic permutations of this, where you cycle the sequence xi, eta, and nu around. So you get three terms. If you combine the term, if you write out all the terms that you get here, then you can rewrite that as, well, in this form here. It's a little tedious to see. In the case where torsion is absent, we have that the commutator of the covariant derivatives is equal to the commutator of the vector fields. And therefore, well, if you look at this equation closely, you see that it's covariant derivative of nu in the direction of eta minus the other way around is the commutator. And what we have here is an occurrence of that. You see, covariant derivative of nu in the direction of eta minus covariant derivative of eta in the direction of nu, because there's no torsion, this is just a commutator. So what we have is that this becomes the commutator. And so we have the covariant derivative of the commutator here minus the covariant derivative of xi in the direction of the commutator. But the beauty of this is that this expression is again of that form, only that now this commutator itself is one of the vector fields. It's like the nu here, you see? Nu up here, nu down here. Here this vector field, down there that vector field. So what we obtain is that this whole expression is simply a commutator as well. It's a commutator of xi with the commutator of eta and nu. And then plus cyclically permuted. So we get the three terms, commutator of xi with eta nu plus cyclic. And what we have to show is that that is equal to zero. And that is indeed always zero. And this is easy to see because it's true for every map. I don't know if you're aware of that, but it's a beautiful fact that for any maps, A, B, and C, especially linear maps from a vector space into itself, such as our maps here, these ones, these are vector fields and therefore maps of functions into functions. For any maps, you have that the so-called Jacobi identity holds true. A, commutator B, C, etc., always true, any maps. And that is simply because you can write out what these commutators are. Just spell it out what it is. B, comma C is really B, C minus C, B. And then commutator with A, you get plenty of terms, plenty of terms, plenty of terms. Write them all out, cross them out, it's zero, always. So what this means is that when you have any kinds of maps with an associative multiplication, you have that you have the Jacobi identity. And so ultimately it's a triviality. We know that our vector fields are linear maps, and therefore they do obey the Jacobi identity. By the way, this is also the reason why the Jacobi identity is part of the structure of a Lie algebra. It ensures that these objects can be mapped. The generators, the elements of the Lie algebra need to be able to act as operators. And in order for us to be able to exponentiate them to get Lie group elements. Anyway, so we have these two Bianchi identities which hold no matter what, we will use them, and they are not part of the equations of motion, even though maybe they sometimes look like them, but they are just structural in nature. Okay? Any questions? Yes?
So since the presence like of a torsion tensor changes where you end up when you travel along two differently parallel transported paths, so you end up somewhere else on one path and somewhere else on the other path, can you say something about energy conservation if it's non-existent, if you have a zero torsion vector, something about energy?
This one is easy to answer. Energy is not conserved. It's generally not. You don't need curvature for that. And you don't need torsion for that. Even curvature alone suffices so that energy is not conserved. Energy is only conserved under special circumstances when so-called killing vector fields are present. Otherwise, it's not conserved. There are, by the way, structures in which torsion occurs. For example, in condensed matter physics, in crystals, you can take a crystal and squeeze it, and then in effect, that means that you get curvature in there. But you can also have crystals which have in effect what is torsion. Of course, not if they are just having a regular lattice structure, but you can have torsion for deformed crystals. And if I remember correctly, also a graphene sheets, which are two-dimensional, one layer carbon sheets. If I remember correctly, they have the ability to have torsion as well. I'm not entirely sure about that. Maybe somebody could look that up.
So that's some kind of analogy to GR in condensed matter. Is that what you mean?
Yes, there are plenty of analogies to GR in condensed matter. For example, it has been shown that certain flows of fluids, such as water, lead to an effective motion that is effectively as if there was a non-trivial metric underlying. And so analogs of black holes, for example, have been constructed in theory and in practice made out of water.
Like Hawking radiation or something?
That would be the ideal, that you see Hawking radiation then. But you can calculate what the temperature of that Hawking radiation would be, and it would be super duper cold. But in principle, in a condensed matter system, you have quantum fields, phonons, for example, and in principle, that phonon field should be excited in the same way that a scalar field would be excited in the vacuum. So if you have a black hole and you have a scalar field, then the scalar field should be excited. There should be Hawking radiation emanating from a black hole. Similarly, if you take a fluid and you have a strong pump that through a thin straw sucks fluid out of the tank, then at the point at the opening end of that straw, you create what would be like the singularity of a black hole. And somewhere near at a certain finite distance from that opening of the straw, there would be the horizon. That would be that distance where the flow of the water inwards towards the nozzle, towards the straw's opening, is faster than the speed of sound in that fluid. So as long as you're far enough away from the hole, the flow is slow enough that you can still signal your friends outside and shout to them and they would hear you eventually. But as you get closer to the opening, the speed of the flow speeds up, and eventually it's faster than the speed of sound. Now, phonons are quantized sound waves. And so for these phonons, there would actually be a horizon. And the conjecture is that, and the calculations show, that in the presence of such a phonic horizon, the phonon field should show Hawking radiation. It's just that it would be super cold. This Hawking radiation of phonons would not be measurable. The fluid would be by many orders of magnitude warmer than that radiation. So we don't expect to be able to see that. However, what has been done and gets pretty close to it is the classical theory behind the Hawking radiation. Of course, in order to actually get Hawking radiation, you need to quantize the theory. But you can look at just the wave mechanics that goes into the calculation of Hawking radiation. So you have waves propagating towards a black hole, scattering off a black hole, coming away from a black hole. All of that is highly non-trivial. Imagine you have a black hole and you send some waves against it. You know, some gets absorbed, some gets radiated away, or you have a black hole that just forms, and you have some noise coming along with all the matter that forms the black hole, and then some of it gets sucked in, some of it gets reflected outwards. And all of that is quite non-trivial wave mechanics. But it's crucial for the calculation of the Hawking effect. You just quantize that then, and then you have the Hawking radiation. So there's a classical analog of it. And that classical analog of this particular way in which waves scatter off black holes, that classical analog has been observed. So there have been measurements of water flow in circumstances that mimic a sonic black hole, and then the wave propagation has been found to behave in a way that is also predicted to occur for black holes. In those scenarios where the flow is such that it mimics, to a very good approximation, a non-trivial metric, a black hole metric. I have to say, though, that the way they did it was not the way I created the picture in your mind, where you have a pump and a straw, and then it's in 3D, and it just sucks the water so fast out of this straw that there's basically a black hole forming. Basically, you can't do that. It's just, because think about it, the speed of sound in water is about 1 kilometer per second. So you would have to, you know, you would have to suck the water out with way more than 1 kilometer per second. Because at the nozzle, it would be 1 kilometer per second. But if you want the horizon to be a few centimeters away, can you imagine, you would have to suck it out at like 10 kilometers a second. That's escape velocity from the Earth. It's basically, it's like a huge explosion. You just can't do it. But what you can do is, there are analogs, right? So instead of using the actual speed of sound in the water, you could use the speed of surface waves. Now that makes things much more easy in one regard, but much harder in another regard. And the reason, it's easier, of course, because they're way slower. Surface waves, you know, you can walk along them, so they're not that fast. So you can easily beat them with suitable pumps and so on. But the problem with water waves is that unlike light waves, which have a trivial dispersion relation, the relationship between energy and momentum, or between frequency and wavelength, for light is trivial, it's just linear. For water waves, it's not at all like that. It depends very, the speed of waves depends very much on what the amplitude is of those waves and what the frequency of those waves is. Right? And so the dispersion relation is quite different in water than it is in vacuum. Yeah. But these things have been done or are being done. They're also working on rotating black holes.
Like an analogy in kinetic matter as a rotating black hole, this way.
Yeah, with water. Yeah, just make the water rotating. Can do that. Yeah. And by the way, have you ever noticed that, I mean, coming back to this observation that the speed of water waves depends very much on the wavelength and the frequency of the water waves and the amplitude of the water waves. You may have observed that when you are at a lake or maybe at the sea when it is very quiet, that sometimes there are patches of the sea that look totally polished and clear. And then there seems to be a sharp dividing line and then there's rough. You've seen it, right? I can see you're nodding. Right. And I guess that is because if the water waves are, say, you have small water waves and they propagate with a certain velocity, and let's say the velocity is slow, then, imagine you have water waves and they propagate with a certain velocity. If the wind speed is below that velocity, then no matter in which direction the water waves propagate, they will always propagate against the wind because they're faster than the wind. And that means that they will be attenuated because they run up against the air, so the friction will attenuate them. Right? So as long as the water waves are faster than the wind, they will be attenuated no matter in which direction they go. But if you have that the wind picks up, it's faster, or that the water waves become slower, then it's very different. Because if the water waves are slower than the wind, then they can increase in amplitude because the wind pushes them. And so I guess that the boundary between where the water is just a flat mirror, polished mirror, and where it is rough, is just where you have that transition. I'm not sure exactly what it is, whether it is the amplitude of That's probably the wind, right? No. I'm not sure, but it must be that, right? It must be that in the polished region, it must be that the wind is slower than the water waves, and outside it is faster. Yeah. How did we get to talk about that? From the Jacobi identity there. Right. Any other questions? No? About next week. Next week, Tuesday, is a day without lectures. It's some kind of reading day. And that means that the Tuesday lectures are shifted to Thursday. So we'll have a Thursday lecture next week and a Friday lecture. OK? See you then.